this week's seminar. It's great to see such a nice turnout. Let me start by announcing next week's speaker, who many of us know. It's going to be Professor Bob Kaiser from the Department of Geography, and his talk will be titled EU Accession and the Politics of Rescaling in the Estonian-Russian Borderlands. Okay, so Bob's been working for some time on this particular issue, and I, for one, am very eager to hear what he has to say. Today's speaker actually is also dealing with a borderland, as luck would have it, and it's a great pleasure of mine to introduce Olga Seznova. Olga is actually from Kaliningrad, which, as I told her, I think is actually quite an exotic place to be from. We hear about Kaliningrad, we think about it, we see it on the map, but it's not the kind of place where you think that people actually are born and grow up and live, and so it's quite fascinating in and of itself that she's from there. But Olga did her undergraduate studies in St. Petersburg, and then she came to the U.S. to pursue her graduate degree. She received a Ph.D. in sociology from New York University, and currently she is a really prestigious postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Chicago with the Society of Fellows. So it's the official title is the Harper and Schmidt Society of Fellows in the Liberal Arts in the Social Sciences Division at the University of Chicago. And Olga works on issues involving memory, social memory, identity, and place. And today she'll be talking about material from her forthcoming book. The book is titled Contingent Place, Tenacious Homeland, and the talk is entitled We Have Never Been German, or What Can Kaliningrad Teach Us About Social Memory? So thanks for joining us, Olga.
Thank you, Ted, very much for introducing me in such an interesting way. And I want to thank everybody for coming this afternoon. But in particular, I would like to thank Jennifer and Laura for organizing and helping me to actually come here and be here with you today. So Ted was right that, it's a strange life trajectory to be born and come from such a place as Kaliningrad. And I thought that dealing with issues of the past through writing a dissertation, writing a PhD thesis, would help me to overcome certain issues, that it would be a therapeutic enterprise. But it turned out that I need therapy now, afterwards. I like what historian Carl Becker said about 50 years ago in one of his letters, that the kind of history that has the most influence upon the life of the community and the course of events is the history that common people carry around in their heads. Becker spoke about the condition under which the past has the most vital relation to the present, when it is accessible, graspable to human mind, when it blends facts, narratives, representations, and scenes with emotions, its effectiveness in its relevance, when the actual substance, its content, acquire cultural significance. This is something that another social thinker, Jan Osman, called, a little bit awkwardly to my taste, mnemohistory. Mnemohistory is concerned not with the past as such, but only with the past as it is remembered. That is, the past which is deemed culturally significant and socially relevant. However much I agree with Carl Becker, I feel an unease in one respect. Thinking about the effectiveness of mnemohistory, I continue questioning its modality. Is it really carried in people's heads? If relevance is a foundation of for social effectiveness of social memory, how does mnemohistory become relevant? So I find a kind of reductionism in the otherwise rich and informative studies of social memory today. This history that people carry, it is always conceived as narratives, representations, and imageries locked in people's heads. let's take an example of Holocaust studies and its influence on the political culture of Germany, about which Jeff Olick wrote extensively. Holocaust is perceived and narrated as an event, right? Another sociologist, Rogers Brubaker, working on the issues of memory and commemoration of the revolution of 1848 in Hungary and among Slovakian community, also treats it as an event. There, a struggle over historiography is a struggle to access social goods between two communities, true, but it is still history as knowledge, very instrumental. My thinking was influenced by another example, however. Yosef Yerushalmi makes a point that the Passover Haggadah, and here I draw from his book, Zachor, Jewish History and Jewish Memory, so Haggadah is a reenactment of the Exodus from Egypt. The Haggadah asks the believer to consider themselves as if they themselves were rescued. The ethos of Passover is not to remember, but to relive history. Yet even Passover is, in a sense, a spectacle prescribed and regulated by Haggadah. The participant takes up a point of view or a role to play. So I'm not making here a point that history has relevance, that the past has practical implications for the present. That point has been made convincingly, I believe. But I'm saying that the very ideas and the very ways in which these ideas about the past become relevant are practical. So the point is that even in the best studies, social memory remains in the sphere of purely symbolic exchange, while I believe that the past should be seen as a practical imposition which generates, brings to life, new narratives, images, all that we call social history. So to paraphrase Pierre Bourdieu, social history is the site of dialectic of the opus operatum and the opus operandi, in which the way of doing makes a history. Practicing memory could be an alternative title of my talk. So enough with problems and studies of social memory. Let me talk for a while about problems with Kaliningrad. Kaliningrad is extremely helpful and extremely a gratifying case for understanding the ways other than narrative and representation for a construction of Myanmar history. It is useful because for such a long time there existed such a complete prohibition of history of Königsberg. It is helpful because there did not and still does not exist a mnemonic community which through generations would share in relation to Königsberg, to German city. But what there existed was a partially preserved, fractured, yet real and concrete body of the city, its architecture and its material culture. So today, by examining an ethnographic fragment from the contemporary Kaliningrad, former Königsberg, I hope to convince you that the relevance of the past comes from the ways of practically being in the world and not merely through a consumption of socially disseminated, prepackaged imaginaries and narratives. So, okay, this is probably my most technologically advanced talk, and there may be some glitches. Kaliningrad was known as Königsberg until 1945, city of Immanuel Kant and also, less knownly, Hannah Arendt. She left at the age of 16 to go and study with Heidegger. So the Soviet Union annexed the territory in 1945, and Kaliningrad is one of the greatest cases of expelling the entire German population from territory, replacing it with Russian speakers, mainly coming from other parts of the Soviet Union, more specifically the Russian Federation, Belarus, and Ukraine. And the city was renamed after the communist leader, Mikhail Kalinin, who ironically never visited the city, and was massively rebuilt, but in the Soviet modernist style. So what you see here is actually formerly one of the most densely populated historical area of the city of Königsberg, Kneiphof. That's the example of it on the lower side, and this is how it looks today. A completely empty, abandoned parkland in the heart of the city. How do I change without actually going to? Left? Okay.
Whichever one you didn't do at that time.
Okay, we'll try to work it out. So these are a few examples of how the city looks these days, what kind of restoration or rehabilitation, rather, it underwent after 1945. So the city of the enemy, as it was perceived, and the heart of fascist militarism, Königsberg was never actually rebuilt in its original historical look. So yet, about 60 years later, Kaliningrad becomes known to the world again for its very pompous extended celebration of 750th anniversary, which in official lingo sounded 750th anniversary of Kaliningrad. The point which, of course, was mocked and discussed a lot in local press and among Kaliningraders. Now, Kaliningrad, the celebrations were attended by three presidents, President Putin, Schroeder, and Chirac. Quite an unheard of fact for the smallest administrative unit of the Russian Federation. During celebrations, Putin proclaimed that it is no longer admissible to pretend that nothing existed here before 60 years ago. In the advent of celebrations, the federal money was spent on renovating the city and bringing it up to a decent state architecturally. The number of federal investment, the amount of federal investment was never actually released, and we can only approximately judge what it was by this one fact. A criminal case was submitted to federal court the day after Putin departed from Kaliningrad, suing the municipality for embezzlement of about 200 million rubles that disappeared in the course of restorations. So Kaliningrad, as I said, is known as an enclave which shares no common border with Russia. You may not know the fact that Kaliningrad is the most densely populated enclave that exists in the world today, even compared to Alaska, which has 100 times larger territory but accommodates only 600,000 population. Kaliningrad Oblast is a place of living for nearly 950,000. So, nevertheless, the oblast remained the smallest territorial administrative unit of Russia, occupying only 0.1% of the entire territory and hosting about 0.7% of Russian population. 425 people reside in Kaliningrad city proper, and the median age of Kaliningrad is 38. A direct distance from Kaliningrad to another closest Russian oblast, Pskov, is over 370 kilometers, which probably around 200 miles, right? And on the way to Moscow, you will have to cross states of two independent Belarus and Lithuania. And in the year 2003, a transit visa was introduced for Kaliningraders, citizens of Russia, to go to what now is called the mainland Russia. So I'm going to use this mainland or continental Russia as a referent to Russia and Kaliningrad Oblast, as you know. So here is the map just to give you a sense where the city is located. As you can see, this semi-island is exactly where Kaliningrad is. So another interesting fact may come from comparing two maps, one from the end of 19th century and another the 20th century map. So they present a striking, almost mirror image of territorial enlargement and its subsequent fragmentation. So the German Kaiserreich stretched eastward in 1871, absorbing in its sweep of unification parts of Poland and Lithuania. Its decomposition in 1918 left East Prussia with its capital Königsberg, a German island amidst the newly independent states. That's the left-hand map. Now, a map from the period of 1946 to 91 is another message of empire, when the joining of the Baltic states in the Soviet Union and Poland in the Socialist Bloc extended the Russian space, this time westward. On the maps from 1990 to 2000, one finds again, in place of the former East Prussia, now a Russian fragment squeezed between Poland, Lithuania, and the waters of Baltic Sea. Kaliningrad is often cast as a city of immigrants. First, it is a reference to its history. The inception of the region as a Russian oblast in 1945 was an act of massive population displacement. For example, on the territory of Eastern Prussia, right before it went to the Soviet Union, before the war, before 1941, lived 1,200,000 people. And in Königsberg itself, about 370. So in November 1945, the first Soviet census, the total count of Germans shrunk to 137, of which only 65 resided in Königsberg. Women were more than twice the number of surviving men. Okay. This is a data from another wave of immigration to the region, which followed the decomposition of the Soviet Union in 1991. Rates of fertility dropped dramatically in Kaliningrad, yet the population, the size of the population was sustained due to the immigration, mainly of ethnic Russians from the former socialist republics, former Soviet republics. You can see that states of Central Asia donated the largest number of population of immigrants. Now, the image of Kaliningrad as a city of immigrants is unthinkable without the military force quartered there. After the headquarters of the Baltic Fleet transferred in 1956 from Leningrad to Baltiisk, the permanently stationed in the oblast military personnel counted for 100,000 people, or about 1/8 of the entire population of the region. The withdrawal of the Soviet military force from Eastern Europe in 91 increased the number to anywhere between 120 to 200,000. I mean, the reading of number varies depending on the source. And in 1994, Kaliningrad was transformed into a special defense region or специальный оборонительный регион directly under jurisdiction of the Ministry of Defense of Russia. So, as we learned from sociological literature, high rates of migration may generate social problems and social tension when coupled with a lower quality of life. How does Kaliningrad fare when it comes to economic well-being of its residents? Well, when it comes to evaluating their lifestyle, Kaliningradans do not compare themselves with other Russian regions, but prefer to compare themselves with the Baltic neighbors, Lithuania, Poland, Latvia, Estonia, to some extent. Sweden figures prominently. So yet Kaliningraders still display a common to most Russians demand on the state to provide for social services, high wages in the state sector, and stable pensions. Here I give you just a sense of dynamic of the income growth, federal expenditure per capita, and rates of immigration with four other main regions of the Russian Federation. Actually, three regions and the Russian Federation itself. So the table reflects that there has been just a modest increase in income, and Kaliningrad enjoys the lowest federal subsidy, federal investment, while its rates of immigration are exceedingly high. So you can think that the picture is pretty gloom. However, there is a challenge in trying to evaluate the actual quality of life in Kaliningrad. Some experts on the region calculate as much as 43% of the unaccounted income generated by the gray or illicit economy flourishing in the region. And Kaliningrad compares in this trend with St. Petersburg, another nicknamed bandit city. So spendings, as we know, exceed incomes, which makes us believe that there exists an additional source of income generation. But of course, the presence of shadow capital negatively affects the budgetary system, the fiscal system, and affects the allocation of resources into social security. So we have a picture of a relatively small region here with higher than average in Russia rates of immigration, with a poor population when compared to the nearby states, with an expansive gray economy, or informal economy, with the lowest in the Russian Federation budget expenditure per capita, with deep and difficult issues concerning geography and history. And to add to the picture, I show you that there are over 150 religious organizations operating in the region, of which the Russian Orthodox Church comprises pretty much a half. So that should create some kind of confusion, some kind of identity crisis, perhaps. Let me address the question of geography first. So after political opening to the Western community and simultaneous cutting of mainland Russia, the most existential question for Kaliningraders became, where are we located? And different people answer that question differently. I'll give you the most representative positions. So the governor Yegorov, right before his resignation in 2005, assured that there is more patriotism in Kaliningrad than in any other oblast of Russia, and that 94% of Kaliningraders consider themselves citizens of Russia and the defenders of Russia's interests in the westernmost frontier. Now, Yegorov is the admiral, right? He's a military person here, Navy. A journalist of Kommersant Daily, Oleg Kashin, in contrast, wrote, Kaliningraders no longer think of themselves as Russians. In 5-6 years, with change of the generation in power, the oblast will be lost to Russia. The journalist no longer writes for Kommersant. So the survey conducted in Kaliningrad in 2004 produced quite telling results. And here on the left hand are quotes from the survey. On the right hand, I provided you some excerpts from my focus groups to give you a sense of the logic of thinking about the territory and territorial belonging. So as you can see, shall I? Okay.
Maybe some representative.
Okay, so 19% can feel the Russian spirit in the region. My interpretation of the Russian spirit, and I was not the author of the questionnaire, is that it's some operationalized category of popular consciousness which stands for national identity. 22% do not feel it, do not feel the Russian spirit, but believe that they live in a part of Russia, although not real Russia. And 25% think that even though this may not be Russian territory, they live there, and therefore this is a part of Russia. Good 50% do not feel that it is Russia, but it must be some kind of different Russia over there, and it's certainly Russia because they live there and they claim their belonging. Now, here we really see the split between political identity with the Russian state, expressed as citizens of Russia, national identity as a Russian, and the identification with place. And this split is even more pronounced among the younger generation. 90% of younger people aged under 28 introduce themselves as being from König, and although they have been to the countries of Europe not once, they have never visited the mainland Russia. And precisely this data prompted the Kaliningrad administration to seek federal support for development and educational program to talk about history and culture of Russia in Kaliningrad schools. Now, when it comes to Russians in mainland, they seem to be lacking in awareness about Kaliningrad. A survey conducted in 2003 with a Russian national sample showed that 47% of the respondents, residents of mainland Russia, did not know where Kaliningrad was geographically. And my interlocutors reported often that when traveling in Russia, they were often asked if Russian is still a language official in Kaliningrad Oblast, and if younger people in Kaliningrad Kaliningrad already speak German. So trying to make sense of their fragmented existence and feeling the imminent threat of restitution, my interlocutors evoke ownership as a relation which legitimates their presence in the territory. Ownership lets people and place share in identity. However, if identity of the city can be an extension of its resident's sense of self, then the reverse is also possible. And sure enough, an exchange of properties and characteristics between the place, its landscape, and its inhabitants is a normal way of seeing things in Kaliningrad. And it's not altogether so exotic if you think about the environmentalist theories in cultural anthropology. So I want to step aside for a moment and remind you some ideas of the classics about the relationship between humans and non-humans. So a constitution of persons which involve their intentional identification with inanimate phenomena has been on a theoretical table for quite some time. Discussing totemism, Emil Durkheim stated that nowhere can a collective feeling become consciousness of itself without fixing upon a tangible object. But, and this is very important, but by that very fact, it participates in the nature of that object, and vice versa. A Russian psychologist and avid reader of Durkheim, Lev Vygotsky, pointed to the perceived identity established by thought among animate and inanimate phenomena in language. Expressions like the leg of a table, the elbow of a road, or a bottleneck in modern languages are just few examples that he gave us. Transformism, which Durkheim and Vygotsky registered, is a mode of sociality which could be described as a merger between human and non-human worlds. Its modality is exchange of properties between things and people. And if I had more time, I would, of course, evoke Bruno Latour here, but unfortunately, I have to stick with the classics. So I propose that people develop desire and acquire things not only in order to give them meaning, but also to derive one from them. When people attribute value and character to an object, they do not see the arbitrariness of this value and the meaning that it carries, nor do they care whether this value and meaning are socially constituted, quite the opposite. So people organize themselves and their activities in such a way as to put the object in their center. This means that we should take seriously the power of a thing as if divorced from its source, in order to later understand how the source is constituted. I want to put an object of desire before desire, to make it an object of desire. To reveal how a person goes after a thing, longing and sacrificing and acting accordingly. This acting, this practical engagement with the material world is emotionally charged. It requires physical skills as much as a skill of social networking. It is this practical engagement that results in intimacy that people experience with their things. And it is this intimacy that establishes homology between things and persons, things and selves. Mnemonic substance is the opus operatum, work accomplished, of the doer's work. So how Kaliningrad can help me to explicate these points that I just put on the table? Well, I first want to introduce a particular class of objects that I discovered during my fieldwork in Kaliningrad. I will refer to them as Kaliningrad bric-a-brac or sometimes jetson. So as you can see, this is a collection of pretty dilapidated, ordinary things. They all being dug up, but at some point they all were thrown away. Here is another example of things that figure prominently in life of Russians in Kaliningrad today. So German...
What kind of building is that? Is that a side of town?
No, it's a private room. It's an apartment. Yes, it's a room decoration. So German things have been part of Kaliningrader's life for over half a century. Their use in the beginning was wholly practical. Nothing else could be offered, could be found in the deserted by the war city, and little that was better was offered by the socialist economy. So German beds were slept in and German plates dined on. And if a street sign in German was found, then its metal body would be used to patch a hole in the leaking roof. So coping with life in the impoverished city was practical, pragmatic, and not at all sentimental. A different kind of life had begun for German things in the late 1960s and was reconfigured once again in the 1990s. Teams of men scoured fields, abandoned German estates, and sites of the former city dumpsters searching for what essentially was Kaliningrad, Königsberg trash. A cottage industry of digging transformed the transient object of initial zero value into a class of durable, extraordinary commodities. This is one of the most typical and common good of this kind, an empty glass, color glass beer bottle. So the beer was drunk at some point, and the bottle was thrown away, right? So from a commodity of a lower to zero value, the beer bottle actually went into a commodity of negative value. And it could remain there in the limbo of the ground if it were not for Russians who started digging up small objects, small things from the grounds of Kaliningrad about 30 years later and continue doing it till today. So here I try to present, summarize a social life of such an object, of a beer bottle. And today, such bottle sells for about $3, which is 10 bus rides or a two-month fee of a basic telephone service. So not so low. So few observations can be made in this regard about a jetsam as a good. Its value is place-specific. Its circulation is geographically restricted. A plate fragment stamped with a manufacturer trademark will be of a zero value if it leaves the region or appears in the outsider's hand. Secondly, Königsberg bric-a-brac is a peculiar product. On the one hand, it has limits of production. An artifact of a particular epoch and place cannot be reproduced in a conventional way. Its value is defined by its finitude. On the other hand, its supply is unknown. And digging creates the illusion of its unlimited supply, much like mind has a horizon of its exploitation, but remote enough to allow for planning and prediction of the extraction. So given these ambiguous properties of the good, games of withholding, delaying, or accidentally delivering to a competitor are easy to play. These games are not only emotionally loaded with excitement or frustration, they also have a power to transform social relations. During my fieldwork, I witnessed a friendship being broken over digging, and I also met a family that established a relationship and had a gift exchange with a German family who came to visit them in the apartment that these Russians occupy, which formerly was this German family's home. So thirdly, contrary to ordinary commercial operation in which the instituted logic is that of rivalry of appropriation on the grounds of formal equality, as market tells us, the exchange of bric-a-brac establishes a concrete community of peers who define themselves as privileged by control over circulation and value formation of a restricted corpus of goods, the Königsberg jetsam. Exclusion and discrimination are accepted features of this market. One digger told me that he never sells the thing, his things to outsiders, and Muscovites are not liked particularly. Only the former Königsbergers, he said, share rights of possession. So a person can be identified as being from Moscow by the way she or he misrecognizes a German bric-a-brac for trash. This tacit knowledge, which of course happens often, it is trash after all. So this tacit knowledge, which my respondents had very hard time putting into words and explaining to me, this tacit knowledge defined rights to possession but also a moral worthiness of people who have them. Disavowing an economic interest, therefore, is crucial here. In an interview, one digger explained that German tourists ask me to sell this thing or that. I always say to them back, this is my life, what you see here. And life, as you know, is priceless. So this is one digger with whom I worked. And now let me tell you about digging, real digging, as practice, as a dirty practice. So to dig, one needs a spade, a canvas bag, a flask of vodka, a sandwich, and a strong back. It is men who dig. Digging is physically strenuous and demanding. It is also seasonal, breaking for the long winter when the frozen ground resists even heavy machinery. The digging starts energetically, cutting deep and in broad strokes, first a rectangular contour of the upcoming pit and simultaneously marking his turf. His team partners do the same, but at a respectful distance. When his cut is about 1 meter deep, the real art of digging begins. The digger's pride is not simply in the stuff that he brings up, but it is also in how little he cracks and breaks with his spade. He relies on experience and intuition and sometimes sheer luck. So he cuts the dirt in even slices, and he carefully puts the piles side by side, taking the lumps of dirt and clay apart with his hands. If the earth is soft and dry, which happens rarely in Kaliningrad, notorious for its very wet climate, he may spread it thinly on the side of the pit to search for any pieces that might have come out. Vanya, a 12-year-old boy with whom I went on a practice dig, broke two little statuettes he found that day by sinking the shovel too deep into the ground. This is his mentor, Uncle Misha. So Uncle Misha coached him on the dig. He consoled the boy, but also was visibly displeased. None of the figurines could be salvaged and sold. So Vanya learned early that the code of pride and mastery in this profession is reinforced economically. Now, the diggers deliver their goods to the market, which has been steadily growing in the past decade. They have their clientele: former Navy officers, engineers, university professors, young professionals working at the joint stock firms, and business owners. So why do these people invest their money and time in rubbish? Here are some of the reasons that my interlocutors gave me. They say that these things feel better to the touch. Their surface feels different. They feel good. They are true, original. They come from the earth. They show a real quality of life. They are bridges to the past. They put you in touch with something eternal, teach you something, and they make us normal people. So clearly, Königsberg bric-a-brac stands for something other than junk. It exchanges values, as a theorist Margaret Morse said once, between otherwise incommensurable facets of life. In this case, the place, objects, and selves. The value of bric-a-brac is that it relates the ontology of things to the ontology of persons. They make us normal people. Walter Benjamin's account of book collecting provides an insight into the ownership, the most intimate relation a collector can have with objects. Writing in the period of historical transition, Benjamin observes that collecting is an intellectual practice of staying in touch with the past and with history. Collecting, I will add, begins when the past and the possibility of staying in touch with it assume some relevance in the present and bring some kind of benefit. So here, let us return for a moment to the problems of Kaliningrad that I outlined in the beginning of my talk. Kaliningrad is a region of geographic instability, historically and presently, which translates into the insecurity over its belonging. It is a region of high immigration rates and shrinking state support. The combination generates a popular discourse of competition among locals and the immigrants, and differentiating these two groups becomes an important task. And finally, it's a region whose past strongly evokes cultural conceptions about German propensity for social orderliness and stability. So Lydia Timofeevna moved to her German two-family house in 1946 with the first wave of resettlers. For 50 years, she opposed every attempt by her family to replace the original German home appliances, the sink, the bathtub, faucets, even doorknobs and latches, which with newer details and equipment. She and her husband believe in the superior quality of German things over everything Soviet and even mass-produced Western. Last summer, she finally conceded to her granddaughter's desire to replace a window in her room with a modern window imported from Poland. It became much colder, Lydia Timofeevna complained, since the repair. So in spite of the many different ways in which Königsberg excavated bric-a-brac is used, there is one understanding of these objects that everybody shares, that relation to culture. They are tools of native dwelling, so to speak, objects of ethnography. They stand in what Barbara Kirschenblatt Gimblett called a contiguous relation to an absent cultural whole that may or may not be recreated. Excavation and the reintroduction of German everyday objects to the lived space of home, or the reconstruction of... this is an example of use of the bric-a-brac and how it's being composed. And this is an example of new construction of the elite housing in Kaliningrad with a very specific, very easily recognizable architectural historical theme. So like this reconstruction, these new buildings of housing for the new elite, collecting, digging, buying, and arranging the Königsberg bric-a-brac allow for overlap between the two cultural forms of everydayness, the German and the Russian. Digging, threading, collecting, and displaying are ways of organizing one's own complicated emotional response to the world at the moment of its disturbance, its disturbed balance. Things, in the end, and their placement, are the only ways, the only things that people feel in control of. So competition to excavate the right stuff on the part of the diggers, or hunting down the right thing on the part of buyers, is caught up in the illusio, to use a term by Pierre Bourdieu, a fundamental belief in the interest of the game and the value of the stakes that all players share. So what is the illusio here? And by the way of answering and also concluding my talk, let me use what one of my interlocutors says. I always have to remind myself that digging up all these things and putting them around the house will not make us German. I say the same about changing the city's name back to Königsberg. What's the use if the name can't make us live like Germans? Thank you very much.
Okay, any questions?
some of them command incredibly high prices, and then also other periods in German history where there's also a lot of collecting, most notably from the Third Reich period. So I think there's an interesting parallel here between this part of the world and Germany itself.
Yes, absolutely. So-called nostalgia. Nostalgia is a very interesting and certainly relevant phenomenon here. And I think its relevance is precisely because what is being collected is a part of the nostalgia movement. Elements of East German DDR everydayness, ways in which people lived, the furniture with which they decorated their houses, the packaging of food that they were buying in the state-run supermarkets or grocery stores. So there is this very particular orientation towards the quotidian and marking and absorbing and somehow recomposing that quotidian with things, which is actually very interestingly commented upon, that the nostalgia for Eastern Germans bears completely different meaning from the nostalgia for Western Germans or Westerners who, you know, if they kind of left here, they see in this the fantasy unrealized, or they just treat it as a kind of a exotic other.
I first want to thank you for a not easily prepared presentation, very many-faceted, and really try to be objective. I have two small questions. One is a very, very valid question. For all these livers, do they need a permit from the government?
No.
They don't.
Which?
And
I will elaborate on this.
All right. And my second question is a bit more substantial. You quoted Benjamin, and I think that can attach to it. It's not only about the bric-a-brac, what is being found, but how much German culture does still survive. Is there still a German-speaking population? Are there still any German-speaking schools? Or has it been completely wiped out?
Okay.
First, the second question. There is no German-speaking population. The last school for German children closed in 1948, with the last train departing to go to the West, Allied occupied Western territories. And now it becomes known that a small number of Königsbergers actually managed to stay in the city, even after the repopulation was completed. But in all cases, they changed their identities. They became Lithuanians. They became Italians. They became Polish. Ethnically, because, you know, the Soviet passport had the ethnicity graft in it. And they would even go as far as change their last name. I met few people like that, and it's really a very tragic history, to the point that one woman actually claimed to forget the German language, even though she was 17 when the city was occupied. So there is no one German remaining. And I have to say, however much Kaliningraders claim their love for Königsberg, they are not very acute on learning German language, with the exception for those for younger people who see German as a business opportunity, as a contact opportunity, as a possibility to go and study in German. Other than that, there is not very much interest in reviving the German culture. Here we are most talking about some kind of localism, you know, local identity, which probably attaches itself to Prussia, historical Prussia, than Germany, certainly not contemporary Germany. But this the point that Benjamin was preoccupied with the disappearance of a culture, right, and then his beautiful Berlin Chronicles are such a tribute to the city and trying to capture the life in the city at the brink of its disappearance. I think it's very relevant, and I would like to believe that my readers work in the Benjaminian spirit, even though they don't speak German. May that question?
Thinking about talking about these freelance type people, these diggers on their own. Isn't there any tradition? You said the city is something like, 650 years old. Is there been any tradition, archaeological digs, like in Novgorod, Veliky Novgorod, where they're still digging all the time and coming up with izbista from, way back? Or that's the first question. Or wouldn't, if there's no interest in doing that among the Russian population, wouldn't they be able to attract money from Germany, or bring German archaeologists in there to do really genuine archaeological digs and find really interesting things?
Well, first of all, I think that Germany is pretty exhausted dumping money into the Kaliningrad oblast by now, and became fairly cautious about the amount of aid that goes to the region. But that said, there is actually a strong archaeological tradition in Kaliningrad, both within the history department of the regional state university, but also there is a fairly famous expedition by Vladimir Kulakov, the Moscow-based archaeologist, who'd been working in Kaliningrad Oblast even back in the 1970s. And now he is one of the leading experts on the Prussian culture. But his interest has been mainly with the Prussian settlements prior to colonization by Teutonic Knights in the 13th century. There is a revival of interest in the German archaeology in Königsberg, the expeditions of late 19th century, 20th century. But what I'm talking about is actually quite a different phenomenon, although it stands in interesting relations to the official archaeology. To tell you the truth, professional archaeologists hate diggers. They are very critical of this whole activity because there are a lot of robbing going on, there are a lot of unsanctioned opening of graves. A huge scandal erupted in 1996 when the collection Prussia from the Königsberg Museum, or remnants of this collection, were found on the black market in Moscow. And as it turned out, one of the fortresses was raided by the diggers who came across the collection buried in the underground by the Nazis, and without long thinking, they just sold it illegally to collectors elsewhere. So that's a complicated relationship. That's why I said that these diggers do not need a license. That means they acting against the state regulation. They cannot be legal, actually. But nobody reinforces.
I was just going to say, with regard to the question of the prevalence of German as a language, maybe in Kaliningrad itself it's not spoken much anymore, but a few years ago I saw a German-produced documentary on that entire region, and it seemed to show that, at least in the rural areas, a lot of people were at least bilingual and did remember German and did speak it and did use it, at least in family or among themselves, in many other rural parts of that area.
I would, if you could give me a reference to that film, I would be very interested. I mean, I know the situation is very often told me that in that brief period of two and a half years when Russians lived with Germans, there were, you know, Russians were slowly, were learning some words, some German. But my sense was that actually Germans learned Russian at much higher rate than the other way around. But it's an interesting point.
Right, well, this is mainly among older people. I probably dated back to when it was part of Germany.
But then so many of them have evacuated.
Right.
It's a surprise to hear this.
What's behind the population or the immigration boom? You mentioned before that so many countries donated people to go there.
Well, mainly, ethnic tensions that Russians experienced in former Soviet republics, especially their large movement from Kazakhstan.
So they're going there by choice.
They go in there by. The destination is by choice. Yes. Large number moved from Latvia and Estonia, especially in the years when Estonia adopted a pretty harsh attitude to granting citizenship to ethnic Russians. Another attraction of Kaliningrad is that it is in this transit zone between Europe and Russia, and that attracted a lot of economically minded people, entrepreneurs, who saw it as the possibility to start join companies or help with transit of secondhand cars through Kaliningrad to Russia. So there was a economic possibilities, especially when Kaliningrad region was the free economic zone.
And also, does the central government promote immigration to Kaliningrad because are they afraid of losing it to some other country?
Till recently there was no organized program until about 4 months ago, when a new governor was appointed by Putin, and one of the governor's new programs is bringing in 400,000 new immigrants to Kaliningrad in the next 5 years.
From Russia in particular, from the mainland?
From mainland Russia. And it's a very controversial program, and it's very much resisted proposition in Kaliningrad.
Yeah, I mean, just a follow up on that, and then maybe a question or comment beyond. But on the immigration, the large number from Kazakhstan would lead me to think that at least part of that is the remnants of the German population that were deported from the German autonomous territory, and undoubtedly most of them speaking Russian now. But nonetheless, and I'm wondering if you have any sense of that, because Kazakhstan really stood out there.
Yes, that's a significant portion of Russian Germans who moved from Kazakhstan to Kaliningrad. In 1992, there was an idea of turning Kaliningrad into an autonomous.
That's what I was going to follow up with. The Congress of People's Deputies, even before the breakup, were thinking of Kaliningrad as sort of a window on the West, and let's, instead of recreating the Volga German ASSR, let's move some Germans into this area, and maybe German, that'll be sort of a magnet for German investment almost. It didn't go anywhere, of course, but.
Yes, it didn't happen, although a large number. I don't have it, on top of my head, how many actually moved, but it was sizable population of Russian Germans. The dynamic was basically they tried to get the German citizenship, and many of them passed Kaliningrad, moved to Germany.
And that's the idea,
But then they returned.
Because a lot of people that I talked to about this whole notion, they said, well, our end goal is to get to Germany. I mean, we have little interest in sort of resettling Kaliningrad. So.
Yes. Although strangely enough, there there's like return emigration now of Russian Germans from Germany, and specifically Chekhovian Red, where they become business owners and double citizenship, dual citizenship gave them great economic opportunities.
And then just a comment, sort of the work that I've been doing is in Narva, so the Russian Russian population, like inside the borders of Estonia, and there, very much that sense of a local identity. That I mean, they sort of overwhelmingly, pointedly say we aren't even not that we aren't Russian, but that we don't belong to Russia. That we are Narvans, and so the identity, that local identity, even sort of is the primary identity that the population overwhelmingly talks about. And there, the idea of social memory is almost we were remade in, after World War II into Narvans because we came from so many different places within within the Russian Federation, within other places. We don't think of any place else as home anymore. And I even had people say phrases like, we came to rebuild Narva after the war and were remade into Narvans in the process. So that whole notion of we are, I mean, we do have sort of that social cohesiveness and social memory, and it's sort of deeply connects us to this particular place, which also means, and I think it's even more profound, of course, in a context like Narva, because they're not welcome anywhere else in Estonia, and yet they don't feel really connected to, across the border to Russia either, and it's very hard to get across that border nowadays. So that sense of sort of really deep roots, even though not deep in time, really sort of strong sense of a network that connects them to that place is there.
Yes, it is very similar in Kaliningrad, although of course claiming a complete remake has severe political consequences in Kaliningrad, which it probably wouldn't in Narva. But it's very interesting.
Yeah, well, and also sort of the remaking of the place and is happening in very different ways, and I'll talk about that next.
I should come.
One more question or comment?
Yes, I think there are more.
Would there be a potential for serious social unrest when they're talking about people who say, I was born here, but I don't really feel like I belong anywhere? It reminds me of these young Arabs in Holland or in France or somewhere. Has there been any problems with that sort of problem? Or is there potential for that sort of problem among young people in the country?
It's a question that troubles me all the time that I'm in Kaliningrad, when I hear people speaking and you register all the necessary conditions almost for the unrest, but it's incredibly non-political region. You know, the party scene is dominated by Единая Россия, the president's party, overwhelmingly. There is not much dissent actually going on. And when it comes to everyday life, I feel that the business activity is so vibrant that the business interest overwhelms the political ethos almost. And of course, you know, politics and economics are connected, but that link is not articulated yet in Kaliningrad, which may become different, you know, with Russia pushing to WTO and Kaliningrad business losing because of that, clearly. So things may change, but no, there is not much social unrest in Kaliningrad. It's a very comfortable provincial kind of burger bourgeois feel to the city.
Okay. One last question.
This is like probably pretty easy and maybe simple, but as far as the socioeconomic status of who the diggers are these sort of poorer people who are doing this as supplemental income, and then on that cultural level, are they keeping the items themselves to feel sort of, you know, like I have something special and this connects me to this upper class historical thing? Because I noticed you said that sort of wealthier younger people are the ones interested in collecting.
Yes, but younger and better people, you know,
invest in actually obtaining things. And those who do tend to be either, you know, state planned workers, so they have more time, more free time, or laid off workers or unemployment. And the stratification actually increases, increased compared to, let's say, the same practice 20 years ago, when you could find engineers and constructors and, you know, sort of intellectual professions also in digging. Right now there is a split and stratification, and it becomes that the diggers are laborers, basically.
You might even get more of that in this area. I know when I was in stuff at the university, this idea of those who go out and do the archaeological digs always involves school kids because it's cheaper, but also because they want to sort of get the school kids out to dig up the artifacts of Alexander Nevsky and things like that. So it sort of instills this idea of digging in a different kind of context as their kids, and that sort of carries over too, or at least some talk about why, when they talk about why they dig, that's a part of it as well.
Certainly the resistance assumptions that these Kaliningrad diggers meet from the state, and they, you know, they hustled by police all the time, that actually produce very different emotional feeling about the context, right? The Russian power structure for them, combined with the object of their activity, the bric-a-brac itself, it constitutes very different perception of culture, and, you know, what they're doing ethically, as compared to when Russian and did Alexander Nevsky in Leningradskaya Oblast and do it legally, right, enforced and applauded by school and parents. Certainly very different emotional state.
Okay, well, it's 5:15, our customary closing time, so let's thank once again for your attention.
I feel now that we need to dismantle the
the apparatus.